Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary by Stephanie Hitt, Georgia Logothites, Dave Lundy, and Jim Prescott. Our program tonight coming to my home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, it's brucedumont@museum.tv. And if you'd like to tweet us a comment, it's @Dumo. And you can go to our website, beyondthebeltway.com. Should you want to watch or listen to any of our previous broadcasts, we keep them there for a long time. That's beyondthebeltway.com. We have a very busy 2 hours planned for you tonight. This last week was a very busy political week. We want to get your reaction to much of what was going on. But, of course, it was the devastating news that an American was beheaded by ISIS. The video was released recently, and this is Peter Kesick, who had recently converted to Islam, a Muslim. And this afternoon, President Obama offered these words concerning his death. Today we offer our prayers and condolences to the parents and family of Abdul Rahman Kesick, also known to us as Peter. We cannot begin to imagine their anguish at this painful time. Abdul Rahman was taken from us in an act of pure evil by a terrorist group that the world rightly associates with inhumanity. Like Jim Foley and Stephen Solotoff before him, his life and deeds stand in stark contrast to everything that ISIL represents. While ISIL revels in the slaughter of innocents, including Muslims, and is bent only on sowing death and destruction, Abdul Rahman was a humanitarian who worked to save the lives of Syrians injured and dispossessed by the Syrian conflict. While ISIL exploits the tragedy in Syria to advance their own selfish aims, Abdul Rahman was so motivated by the anguish and suffering of Syrian civilians that he traveled to Lebanon to work in a hospital treating refugees. Later, he established an aid group, SIRA, to provide assistance to Syrian refugees and displaced persons in Lebanon and Syria. These were the selfless acts of an individual who cared deeply about the plight of the Syrian people. ISIL's actions represent no faith, least of all the Muslim faith, which Abdul Rahman adopted as his own. Today, we grieve together. Yet we also recall that the indomitable spirit of goodness and perseverance that burns so brightly in Abdul Rahman Kesick and which binds humanity to all together ultimately is the light that will prevail over the darkness of ISIL. End of quote, President Barack Obama this afternoon. Dave Lundy, there have been five of these beheadings, and we should mention that the beheading of Peter was surrounded by the mass beheading of several Syrians as well. It is the largest recording of more than one being beheaded at the same time. How many beheadings will it take before the American people move to a more aggressive response to what needs to be done? Or are they perplexed by these stories?
I think they tend to be perplexed. I will tell you, I'm a bit perplexed by when I hear there was a report on Friday, excuse me, of a of all these Westerners, Western Europeans, teenagers, people in their 20s, people who come from solid families, all of whom are increasingly attracted to this brutality, and it's just it's the kind of thing that I think makes most Americans, certainly myself, just beside myself trying to wrap my head around folks who see this level of evil and say, this is good. I don't get it. And it's tough.
Jim Prescott joins us, first time on the program. Nice to have you with us.
Thank you, Bruce.
Republican operative for many years, now in your own with your own public affairs firm. What is the reaction of you, your friends, and the colleagues? And is the goal here to rile up the American people so that we send more troops there?
You know, I'm not sure what the goal is exactly from ISIL. It clearly it begs the question of reevaluating and taking another look at the strategy. I think the Obama administration cautioned early when earlier this year that this was going to take a long time. And clearly ISIL has the resources, and there's got to be some Achilles heel, some weakness points in there that we can attack. Is dropping more bombs on them the answer? I'm not sure yet, but clearly this is, and I share Dave's confusion as to why this appeals to Westerners. If my kids came to me or their kids were interested in this, I'd be beside myself.
Georgia Logothaides joins us. She is a columnist for the Daily Cost. Georgia, nice to have you with us.
Thanks.
The propaganda value of these videos and of these beheadings, where are they gaining? Where are they gaining, and why is this seed within young people of Western upbringing, why is it taking hold?
Well, this goes to the larger, those videos are part of a larger strategy. Mm-hmm. And I think that when we look at the social media strategy that they've employed, it's unbelievable how they've leveraged the social media aspects, whether it's, specific hashtags, whether it's these videos. They know how to make something go viral, and not just because of its shock value. And what happens is when you cast that wide of a net, you're going to hit vulnerable personalities. You're going to hit those lonely teenagers that don't have any friends, the ones that are looking for that. And there was actually a report, I forget exactly who was reporting, but they were saying how essentially there are recruitment teams within ISIL that basically just spend their entire days online actively seeking out these, disaffected youths online. And there's also females that are part of the, terrorist group that go out and reach out to young females as well. So it's a very sophisticated communication strategy.
But this core that you're talking about, that I think we all fear, that's also the same core that we hear from time to time, not necessarily related to ISIL, but, 5 or 6 times a year there will be some American teenager that will shoot up a mall or a school, and they have many of the same common denominators that these young people are gravitating to, and they lash out in a very violent way. Stephanie, well, you're a mother.
It is startling the way in which, just as some people are caught up in the goth movement that we saw with the Columbine, there's a lot of similarities with those that now see this terror, these groups that are springing out of the Middle East and so on. I think what's really startling about this is that when you asked, who is this latest video for, it's not just to anger the West, it is to recruit more in the West, because we're looking at groups where they rule through power. It's about power and domination, and for those who feel powerless, and they're seeking that, they're looking for that.
Well, it seems to me that in this particular case, it's not just the evil West, but in this particular case, albeit Peter was a U.S. Veteran, the reality is here's someone that converted to Muslim, and regardless of that action, he still lost his head and lost his life. So, I mean, it's...
I want to talk
more about that when we come back. I also want to get reaction and find out how those listening and watching the program feel. 1-800-723-8289. Are you shocked by these stories, and how many more stories do we need before there is an escalation and a demand for more action against ISIL? Back shortly from Chicago.
Everyone loves vacationing in Florida. So why not experience it as it was meant to be? Where turquoise Gulf waters meet tranquil island beaches. Feel the powder-soft sand between your toes. Revel in a glorious island sunset. Shop the boutiques of a seaside village. Ride horseback along tranquil waters. This is Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Real, authentic Florida, where you can discover an intimate downtown and sip cappuccino at a sidewalk cafe. Catch fresh fish for dinner. Even tour a working winery. Just minutes from all the rest Florida has to offer. Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Plan your visit online at BradentonGulfIslands.com. That's BradentonGulfIslands.com.
Sean, back in Chicago, thank you very much for joining us tonight. We're talking. I want to pick up on the point about the aggressive recruitment and the sophistication they're showing in social media. What do we know about who's doing this and how they're being trained? Or is it just an indigenous awareness of social media and how it works?
Yeah, I mean, they're taking basic concepts, right? When you have a very large platform like you would on Twitter or Facebook or YouTube, right, you dog whistle your politics, and they know exactly who their base is, which are people that already have an anti-American sentiment. And I think what we're watching right now is the marriage of two very kind of unfortunate events. One is the extreme rise of anti-Americanism in the Middle East and obviously in certain parts of Europe as well. And then we're also watching ISIL rise up as a powerful force, and they're taking advantage of that anti-Americanism. And I think one aspect of the story that hasn't gained a lot of attention is with respect to Turkey and the anti-Americanism that we've seen in Turkey. Turkey actually now has fighters that are flowing into that fight. And I think that's in large part to the type of environment that Turkey's government and certain elements within Turkey are creating, which is an environment of anti-Americanism. And we saw that this week when three U.S. soldiers were attacked and bags were placed over their heads. You know, it was an unfortunate event, and it was just indicative of a much larger problem that, you know, we're not really facing.
Well, how should we be facing it? Dave, how should we be facing it? I mean, now, we all know that, because we've been talking about it for 2 years, we know the power and influence and abilities of the National Security Agency. They're obviously tapping into this stuff. Mm-hmm. So can that be predictive if they're, or are they going even below the ability to be trapped and listened to by the NSA?
Well, it seems to me that the objective question is one that has to be asked, which is our objective to prevent another attack on the homeland? Is our objective to prevent ISIS from forming a safe haven the way the Taliban did in Afghanistan? And clearly the administration and, frankly, you know, most people who've looked at this situation have struggled with what is the right way to do it, because clearly they are baiting us, and they've been baiting us. They want American troops. They want a lot of American troops to go in there, because then they have the holy war. That was Osama bin Laden's entire approach. And so, you know, there is a balance. And what's interesting, and I know this has been frustrating to a lot of folks, myself included, is – you know, we're using American firepower in the war on ISIL, and we're partnering with troops on the ground, and it's having some positive effect in some parts of the country with some very imperfect partners, particularly in the Iraqi army. But you know, why aren't we doing 100 sorties a day, 1,000 sorties a day instead of 5 or 6 or 7? And so where is that balance? It's really hard to say.
Well, one of the responses would be that if you do that, you're killing more, perhaps, innocents, which is only going to exacerbate the problem. By the way, one of the masked militants, and I want to get everybody's reaction, one of the masked militants said today, to Obama, the dog of Rome, today we are slaughtering the soldiers of Bashar, and tomorrow we will be slaughtering your soldiers, in a prediction that Washington would soon send troops to the region to fight the Islamic State. And then goes on to say, quote, and with Allah's permission, the Islamic State will soon begin to slaughter your people in your streets. End of quote. So this clearly is it's a baiting strategy with their video, with their rhetoric. How should we respond? Do we have to just be diplomatic? Because, as you know, when people hear these words and they see the videos, and by the way, do we know, or at least I don't know, how many people are watching these videos? Have you watched?
I would not choose to watch one, but they're not that easy to get a hold of. I don't
know.
Has anyone
at the table watched a beheading?
No.
Okay.
No. No.
I've heard in great detail about some of them, right, because I have family members who
very
have.
Graphic. Then why is it so difficult to find those videos?
A lot of it is, I think most people would agree that it's just not helpful to see those kinds of things. They're pretty awful.
To some degree, you know, self-censorship as well. You know, yeah. They're so graphic,
right,
that, you know, once they go up and media gets access to them,
right,
it's probably not the most responsible move to show
it's not the cleanest way to
video.
Go.
But what happened is, with the and I will admit this, with the first beheading, I felt, as a journalist, I wanted to see with my own eyes.
Yeah.
I spent almost a half a day and then gave up. There was no way for me.
Be easier to find the video of Kennedy's assassination.
Well, to find all of the video links. So
I mean, we go to mainstream sources, right? So we search on YouTube, which obviously takes down the videos. We search there, but I mean, these videos are meant for an audience that doesn't live on the normal internet, right? They live in the underbelly of the internet on forums with torrents and everything like that. So those videos
mean? Say that in easy to understand.
Sure,
language.
Sure.
That's what Bruce can understand.
Well, I'm sure I'm not the only one that didn't understand everything you just said. But I want to understand about the undercurrents.
Yeah, I mean, well, the posting of a video, posting it on YouTube is just one way of accessing a video online. There are a generic way. There are peer-to-peer sharing networks, and that's really where these videos get shared, especially outside of the United States, right? So somebody hosts a video on their computer, and it gets shared a million times all across Europe and Africa and Asia, and that's really their audience, right? The people that aren't outside of the mainstream.
Bruce, I want to come back to something Dave said, though. I think that's probably could be at the heart of the matter here, which is what are the objectives? Not only theirs, but ours. And I think this may be potentially an opportunity to either more clearly define those objectives and communicate those to the American public. Not only what are our objectives besides, the airstrikes, which, for the last, 60, 90 days or so, have they been effective?
Mm-hmm.
Probably the jury's still out. It's a mixed bag probably if you ask most people. But I think the bigger question is a parallel question is what are their objectives? What do they want in terms of what do they want from us? What are their objectives in the Middle East, around the world? And I don't think that's been clearly defined either. I think that's part of the equation. Let's not forget that.
I do want to get everybody's reaction. Well, what do you think? Let me put one thing in context. And then let's focus on it because it's a really good question. When the first response to 9/11 happened militarily, President Bush said, and I'm going to paraphrase now, we're going to fight them there so they don't fight us here.
Right.
We now have a situation where, because of our military action, to some extent, it has escalated and made things worse in the region for some people. It's splintered off into a variety of different groups that hate us, including ISIL. They are now threatening to come and get into the United States. We fortunately intercepted some of them. All it takes is for one to get through, but they're looking for another Grand Slam home run somewhere, and I think everybody understands that. And Republicans, Democrats, liberals, conservatives fear that. So if that's their goal, other than being vigilant, do we still have some reason to continue, as George Bush said, to fight them on their soil, which means more troops, more bombs, and we kill as many of them as possible before they kill us?
Well, the part of the problem of all this is really the sympathy for America and the public relations war that's being battled right now. And that's part of it. I don't think there's any question at all that if America had the will and wanted to end this, we could do it militarily. There's no question. But the problem
I'm not sure that's so
I mean,
clear.
I just think in a technical, physical sense, we could. But the problem is that we had international support when we went into Afghanistan and even into Iraq to some degree. But that wore off as things went on and on. That started to wear down the longer we were there, and that's why we pulled out. The problem is that we aren't at a point where we can go back in with the same vigor because we don't have the same sympathies worldwide as well.
But isn't the core here that they want to come after us because they hate us? They hate us for who we are. They're using as a justification that we've had military action in their region. The reality is, if we had no military action in there, and if we turned our back on Israel, they would still
hate us. Absolutely, yeah.
They would still come after us.
There's no appeasement.
There is no answer. There's no capitulation you can do that is going to satisfy them. Part of this is about, and I say this very specifically, it's self-aggrandizement in the classic. They are trying to elevate themselves. They are trying to aggrandize themselves and turn themselves into the force. They are the successors to Osama bin Laden. They're going to do what he was never able to do, capture territory, create a safe haven, use oil revenues. And the reason that we can't just turn our backs and ignore this and say, let's just keep pinpricking them and see how that plays out, is because they can't be allowed to develop a safe haven with oil revenues, because the consequences for the entire Western world, including the United States, are potentially catastrophic. And as you'll recall, when they first captured Mosul and captured the bank at Mosul and took $400 million, that's what first scared the bejesus out of me. Because with that level of money and with the money coming in from the oil revenues, you can do a lot to buy some nuclear scientists.
And you know, we've talked a lot about the United States and what the United States should do. I mean, this is not just a United States problem.
Right.
It's a European problem.
Right.
It's a Middle Eastern problem. It's an African problem. And so I think that unlike, you know, our previous foreign policy issues, you know, with respect to Iraq and Afghanistan, I mean, this is truly a holistic issue that needs everybody at the table, including our European partners, because it directly affects them. Just like somebody could board a flight to the United States, they board a flight to London.
What specifically can we do?
Well, I think
we've beefed up our airports.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Okay. What's next?
Well, we're playing defense.
In terms of protecting our interests here.
But again, we have to play defense. But the question is, to what extent do we play offense? And that's, I think, it is that second question that's a little more difficult for us.
It is. Right. Well, and they've been, it's sort of that sleeping lion that gets just sort of attacked here and there, and it at some point they're hoping to stir it up and have something big happen.
We've got a pause. 1-800-723-8029 from coast to coast and border to border. I'm Bruce Dumont. Nice to have you with us tonight.
Are you headed to Los Angeles? Looking for the ideal place for you and your family to relax and enjoy yourselves? A place that combines a Four Diamond Hotel experience with a convenient location? It's the Hilton Los Angeles Universal City, just steps away from Universal Studios Hollywood, CityWalk, and NBC Studios. Just a short ride to the Hollywood Walk of Fame, TCL Chinese Theater, Warner Brothers, and other popular attractions. Enjoy spacious rooms offering breathtaking views and a world-class Las Vegas-style seafood and prime rib buffet every weekend and holidays. Share family fun and enjoy the oasis of the palm tree-lined pool and whirlpool. Relax in your own private poolside cabana with a cocktail or snack at your fingertips. Book your reservation today at HiltonUniversal.com or call 1-800-774-1500. The Hilton, Los Angeles, Universal City at HiltonUniversal.com. They let you be the star in Hollywood.
Back in Chicago, thank you very much for joining us this evening. Let me have our guests now introduce themselves, and we start with Georgia Logothetis.
Hi, how are you? I'm Georgia Logotheti. I am a contributing editor at DailyCoast.com. I'm also a political consultant and managing director of a national foreign policy group.
Stephanie.
I'm Stephanie Hitt, and I am a reformed lawyer and a Republican activist living in Evanston, Illinois, the fifth friendliest to liberal city in the country. So I have daily challenges, and I'm a mother of four.
Dave Lundy.
I'm president of Aileron Communications, a public affairs strategy firm. I have two wonderful kids, Eli and Max, who insist I give the shout-out to them every time, and I live in the suburbs.
Jim Prescott.
I'm Jim Prescott. I've got my own public affairs consulting firm in the western suburbs. I'm from Oak Park, the People's Republic of Oak Park, as I like to call it. And my wife, Sally, and I have five kids, two out of college, two in college, and one in high school. So I have to keep working.
Right. For many years, I worked for Republican Governor Jim Thompson for many years.
That's where it all started, back in Thompson's
office. I love the fact that our Republicans are from the People's Republics of Oak Park and People's Republic of Evanston. What can I tell you?
They form a very small Republican caucus.
Very small.
Yes,
Before we get back to our national discussion, I do want to take a moment and share with our Chicago audience and also our national audience, because, again, there was some notoriety to the passing this week of Chicago's first female mayor, Jane Byrne. Jane Byrne beat the machine back in 1979 in the city of Chicago. It rocked politics in this city. And what followed Jane Byrne was Harold Washington, the first African-American elected president. Mayor of Chicago. And I said that at that particular time that there would not have been a President Barack Obama had there not been a mayor, Harold Washington. And everyone around the table that night sort of agreed with it. So I would say the same thing tonight. I don't think there would have been a Harold Washington had there not been a Jane Byrne. Not only because Jane Byrne did what she did, which was sort of to dare Harold Washington to run. It was a very bad political calculation on her part. But again, she did prove to people living in Chicago that a focused campaign, you could beat the machine. And she did it at a time when no one thought it was possible. Again, the first woman mayor of a major city. And I just want to get reaction, just spend a few minutes, because people around the table know of certainly her legend in this city. And Georgia Logothetis, yeah. let me start with you.
I absolutely agree with that premise. I mean, she shattered the status quo. You know, she did something that people today only dream about doing, and she did it in a manner that was very engaging, especially, and it connected with voters in a way that we don't see people connect with voters today. And absolutely, I think it opened the door for, you know, Mayor Washington, and then obviously for Barack Obama, because it provided a template for that type of run.
Stephanie, she was also victim of a great deal of sexism.
Well, and, you know, it sort of brings to mind another well-known politician who experienced that and rose above it well with her own will, and Margaret Thatcher obviously faced that in her own tenure. And I think there's a lot of similarities. I mean, you have to be a pretty strong woman who's willing to face that sexism and to overcome it and use it to strengthen herself. So she was a very forceful woman, and it almost made her stronger, I think.
Dave Lundy.
You know, I like to think about to recall the fact that Jane Byrne set certain things in motion in Chicago that forever made the city better. Jane Byrne was the person who came up with the idea for Chicago Fest, which became Taste of Chicago. Jane Byrne made sure that mayors plow the snow. Yeah. For those of us who survived the polar vortex
grateful.
In this town, we are eternally grateful.
Because we should mention to the national audience, I mean, one of the principal reasons why she was able to beat the machine was the incumbent mayor, Michael Blandick, and his Department of Streets and Sanitation did a very ineffective way or process of cleaning the streets after a huge snowstorm in 1979. And there seemed to be some favoritism not only in snow clearance, but also in transit, public transit service to the south and west sides, which were populated then and now by the black population. And she riled everybody up because Mayor Blandick couldn't handle the snow.
Exactly. And so, you know, we all will benefit from that. And she just, you know, talk about upsetting the apple cart. You know, Jane Byrne saw an apple cart and she wanted to just throw it over. And, you know, it made for some tumultuous times in the city, and not everything she did was right, like the State Street Mall and so on. But it really, she had a lasting impact. And you think about a mayor who was only there for a short time, you know, that's really extraordinary.
Jim Prescott, you were with the Thompson administration when she was running City Hall.
Mm-hmm. She was, I think, looking back on her now, probably one of the shrewdest politicians, not just in Chicago, but certainly in the state at the time. And she brought those instincts, but also the skills and other attributes to the office. And she also, as Dave mentioned, she was the beneficiary of a weak opponent in Michael Blandick, politically tone deaf, and who, from an administrative and a managerial standpoint, couldn't get the streets plowed.
Right.
And she was in the right place at the right time and knew how to use that to her advantage, and that's why she won, among other reasons.
A very small media campaign compared certainly to today, but again, the picture of her when the snow is down, it was the picture of her in that commercial shoot, because it was filmed on a day that was snowing. It constantly reminded everybody how upset they were with the way the city was administered. And again, when she ran for reelection, her whole thought was that Richard M. Daley, who was the state's attorney, would be someone that wanted her job. And he did want her job. And much of her strategy in that first term was positioning herself to beat him in a primary, because she knew that he was coming after her. And so some of the things that she did deliberately riled up the black community. She wanted a black opponent. She did not know that by creating, and she did things that really riled up the black community. She threw out white members of the Chicago Housing Authority who were African-American.
She moved into Cabrini Green.
She moved into Cabrini. Yeah. She did all kinds of things, a lot of it that was kind of riling up the black community, because she wanted a black candidate. She didn't realize that by egging a black candidate in, the candidate would be Harold Washington. And when he got in, that fire that she ignited turned into a prairie fire, and it swept her and all of her mathematics mm-hmm. of how she was going to win a three-way race went out the window. And Harold Washington finished first in that primary. Jane Byrne finished second. Rich Daley finished third. He ultimately came back later. And I think also something else, and I'll say it, and a lot of people may not want to acknowledge what I'm about to say is accurate, but I do think that the way in which Jane Byrne was basically shunned and exiled by the power elite once she fell. She made a comeback 4 years later. She lost in a primary to Harold Washington in 1987. And then there was a flirtation that she was going to run for a county office as well. But again, what happened is she became a pariah in the city that she once was the mayor of. And that attitude and that aura was orchestrated by Richard M. Daley. He had such a vile hatred of Jane Byrne, he made the rest of her life miserable. And it's not to his credit, that he did what he did. But, again, there won't be a lot of people saying, Bruce, you're right on, you'll do that. But I think most people in their heart know exactly what I'm talking about. And he went way beyond what should have done, and she was given no respect, with the exception of within the last 6 months when it was apparent that her days on this earth were going to be very short-lived, that there was a movement by Ed Burke, a long time, the longest-serving member of the Chicago City Council, to name a small park after her. And there was a ceremony, and the mayor now, Mayor Rahm Emanuel, understood and addressed some of the concerns that I just referenced, that she was an innovator. She did make history. And again, sometimes when you make history, you make some very powerful enemies that make your life miserable. And she did, and she will rest in peace. And to her daughter, Kathy, the service will be tomorrow. And again, our prayers go out to her, because she had a pretty remarkable mother who made a significant mark on the city of Chicago. And again, just to put it in context to our national audience, there would not be a President Obama. Now, you may like the idea, or maybe you hate the idea that there's a President Obama. But if you look at the politics of it, and you go back and you look at the seeds that were planted, they lead to the door of Jane Byrne. We're going to switch gears. One of the issues that obviously the U.S. Senate is going to have to deal with, and it's been a political football for quite some time, is the Keystone Pipeline. And Jim Prescott, you have been working on this project for a long time, so you have unique awareness of it. In 1,000 words or less, what is the Keystone Pipeline, and what is the big political blockage that exists to its completion?
Well, what's in question right now is the fourth of four phases of the Keystone Pipeline system. I bet if you ask 10 people on the street if this is a brand new pipeline system, they'd 10 of them would probably say yes. Mm-hmm. As you say, Bruce, I've been involved with Keystone, the pipeline system, for several years now. The first three phases have been up and running for the last 2 or 3 years, almost 4 years now with phase one. And what's in question right now is the extension, or the fourth phase of it, of Keystone XL, which is routed through Montana, South Dakota, and Nebraska mm-hmm. to connect with the existing system.
And it starts in Canada.
Correct.
And it goes to Steel City, that's in Nebraska.
Steel City, Nebraska, right at the Kansas
State line. And that's phase one or phase two, or what
that
phase
is phase
that?
Four. If there's other phases, that's from Steel City South. That's already in service.
That's working. I want to come back and talk more about that and also take some questions. 1-800-723-8029. I'm Bruce Dumont from Chicago.
Everyone loves vacationing in Florida. So why not experience it as it was meant to be? Where turquoise Gulf waters meet tranquil island beaches.
Feel the powder-soft sand between your toes. Revel in a glorious island sunset. Shop the boutiques of a seaside village. Ride horseback along tranquil waters. This is Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Real, authentic Florida, where you can discover an intimate downtown and sip cappuccino at a sidewalk cafe. Catch fresh fish for dinner. Even tour a working winery. Just minutes from all the rest Florida has to offer. Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Plan your visit online at BradentonGulfIslands.com. That's BradentonGulfIslands.com.
Back in Chicago, and we're talking about the Keystone Pipeline. Let me ask Georgia, are you for or against the Keystone Pipeline, Georgia?
Well, from an environmental perspective, I'm against it. I think that there are valid arguments on the other side. I think that, you know, it's not an easy issue. It's not one of these black and white things. I think that it's one of those policy issues that's filled with nitty-gritty facts on both sides of the aisle. Both sides have merit, and it really depends on what type of precedent we want to set going forward. And I think that from, you know, the research that I've read so far, I don't think we're at the point yet where the types of safeguards are in place and the type of long-term plan is in place to ensure that, you know, a lot of these concerns that are being raised won't be a concern 10, 20, 30, 40 years from now.
Jim, what is the biggest misconception people have about this political debate?
Well, I think
political
it,
debate.
Well, I think one of the questions is has to always be compared to what? You know, if not the pipeline, then what are the alternatives? And the State Department, which is the coordinating agency for not only this presidential permit that we need to build the fourth phase of Keystone, but the other three phases as well, answered those questions again and again and again. There have been roughly a half a dozen environmental reviews on Keystone, and over again, the conclusion is it is environmentally safe. And when you, especially these days, when you compare the alternatives, which is to put oil on trains, the environmental footprint from putting oil on trains is enormous. It is not even a close comparison in terms of cost and risk to the safety of the environment.
Now, one of the things that the president has said is that when he was explaining it the other day, he said, well, really, it's just about Canadian oil going from Canada through the United States. It's going down to the Gulf, and it isn't going to reduce the cost of our oil and gas at all.
Well, I don't think one pipeline by itself can have that much of an impact at the pump. But I think if you look at the overall effect, and we've seen that in the last several months in terms of the supply and production levels in the states, has driven down the cost of oil, 25-30% over the last couple of months. And, you know, we're paying less at the pump today than we certainly did a year ago at this time. The other point to keep in mind is we get, in terms of a larger picture, we use about 15 million barrels of oil a day in the United States. Roughly half of that, and now a little bit more than half of that, is domestically sourced thanks to increased production out of the Bakken, out of the Eagle Ford, out of the Permian Basin, and elsewhere around the country thanks to hydraulic fracturing. The rest of it, though, has to be imported. And our number one importer of oil is Canada. We get more oil from Canada than any other country in the world. And that I think is an important factor to keep in mind. That's not going to change anytime soon, with or without Keystone.
The politics of it is there's supposed to be a vote on Tuesday of next week. Harry Reid finally has said there's going to be a vote on it, and the reason they want to have a vote on it is they want to give an opportunity for Mary Landrieu to vote for it and thus, in his view, perhaps save her Senate seat. Likely to happen?
No, it's not likely to save her Senate seat. I think she's in deep trouble.
She's toast. Mm-hmm.
I think she's pretty close to toast.
16 points down.
It's a beignet.
Oh, it's a little. It's a nothing.
Just a little.
That having been said, you know, it seems to me that I've never quite understood the passion of many of my friends in the environmental community on this issue. I'm an environmentalist. I'm a clean energy advocate. I work in this area. If this oil, if it is not sent through pipeline, is going to be sent through rail on single-layered rail cars that have this horrible tendency to blow up in towns and create enormous devastation, environmental and otherwise, or it'll be sent on trucks. I mean, I don't get it. Now, that having been said, I think that the advocates of the Keystone Pipeline, of which Jim is a great example, way overblow the consequences. It will result in short-term construction jobs. It will not result in an enormous number.
Kind of like the stimulus package?
It will not result in an enormous number. I'm going to ignore you. An enormous number of permanent jobs.
What's wrong with short-term production?
There's nothing wrong.
What's wrong with
it? I'm just saying it's not going to solve
the problem. I mean, a lot of those, there will be some construction jobs that are short-term, but the maintenance of the pipeline and all of that, those will be ongoing continuing jobs. I think one of the other things that we didn't mention here is it's not just Canadian Oil that's coming down through that leg. As Jim was explaining offline, there is an on-ramp for oil from North Dakota. So it will help the American production of oil as well and the distribution of that. And although it may not seem like a lot, the more North American or non-Middle Eastern oil that gets into the available supplies worldwide, the lower those prices are going to go.
How bipartisan is this vote likely to be on Tuesday, Jim?
My understanding is right now they've got 59 votes, and that's even that's before the turnover in the Senate. So it is bipartisan because you've got a Democratic incumbent senator from Louisiana fighting for her political life. She's been on board with this project for a long time. I want to come back to one quick point though in terms of economic impact.
Go ahead. Vetoes it. I want to ask a political question, and then I want to.
He's done it before. There's a couple of different moving parts here. This is not the only game in town, so to speak.
Yes.
There's the issue of the presidential permit itself that's still in play. It's still on the table at the State Department, and they're holding that review while some litigation in Nebraska gets sorted out. But in terms of economic impact and the benefits of this project, the other thing to keep in mind is all the jobs in the Gulf Coast area, the largest refinery complex in the world. This is a stable source of oil to deliver not only domestic U.S. oil, but Canadian oil to that complex.
Jim Prescott and Stephanie Hitt have been with us representing the Republican perspective tonight. Dave Lundy and Georgia Logothetis have been representing the political left, although it isn't too much of a left-right issue this evening as we're talking about issues of national concern. 1-800-723-8289 is the phone number. If you're listening to this program on radio, we have another full hour, and we're going to be talking about immigration. What the president does on immigration, does he move forward with an executive order? And if he does, has he started World War III politically in Washington, D.C.? And we'll talk about some other things when we roll. And if you're watching us on television, we'll see you next week. From Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with hour number two of Beyond the Beltway, tonight featuring commentary by Stephanie Hitt, Georgia Logothetis, Dave Lundy, Jim Prescott, and our phone lines remain open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. You can email us a comment at brucedumont@museum.tv. You can tweet us at Dumo, and you can also go online to beyondthebeltway.com. And during the break, I was checking my email and voicemail, and I got a message from someone who may win the award for listening to this broadcast this evening from the furthest point away. And if you are listening around the world, you may challenge what I'm about to say. But a longtime listener, Jeff Gotland is listening in Auckland, New Zealand. It's 2:00 in the afternoon, and it's raining. And what do you do when you're in New Zealand and it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon and it's raining? You go and you rush to the Internet and you listen to Beyond the Beltway from Chicago, Illinois. So, Jeff, hope you enjoy your day out there. And, again, if you can beat Auckland, New Zealand, give me a tweet at Dumo, and we perhaps will mention that as well. I want to button up the discussion that we're talking about with the Keystone Pipeline, and then I want to talk about immigration. Do you think the president will veto this, Dave? It looks like it's probably going to make it through the Senate. Okay?
My guess is it's veto bait. I honestly I wish he wouldn't. I'm tired of talking about Keystone. I don't think these issues are cut and dried. I think it's time to, you know, let's – this is clearly a bipartisan majority in support of this. Let's just move on.
And politically, I think that – take it off the table. Make a decision. Not just now, but it should have been, you know, 2 years ago. But, right. You know, it's still a football. Why is it still there? It doesn't need to be.
I want to talk now about the immigration issue and what the president, he has threatened for quite some time, that by executive action he was going to allow approximately 5 million undocumented Mexicans, all primarily Mexicans, into the country. He chose not to do it before the election because he thought that some Democrats would be endangered by that. It infuriated many Latino leaders all over the country. And if you look at the drop in Latino turnout for the election, you can see why maybe some Latinos and Hispanics were not very excited about the president. And I think that may have led to at least a couple of maybe Senate losses, perhaps in Colorado, maybe in another state or two. But, again, that's a different – where I'm going with this question is – you're the president. You never have to face the voters again. You want to be loved by your base, and you have opposition that doesn't like you and doesn't want to support you in most things. What's wrong, Stephanie Hitt, with him saying, you know what, I got 2 years left. I know the Republicans are in control of the House. I know they're about to be in control of the Senate. I know that I've lost election after election, but you know what? This is my last shot, and for the next 2 years, by executive action, I'm going to do as much as I damn well please. And you know what? If I piss off a lot of people, too bad.
Well, and
what's wrong with that?
It goes against, I think, the very essence, the nature that we as Americans feel that our, you know, what makes our government work, and that is the fact that we have three separate branches that maybe work together, work against each other, our checks and balances, and to feel that one person, the one branch, feels he has more power and authority than all over the other two is really unlikable.
Politically, what's wrong with that thought, Dave Lundy?
Well, first of all, he does have more power than the other branches. Even Mitch McConnell said that in his post-election address. I think that look, the president has put himself into this box. And you can't ignore that fact. He promised to do this, and then he went ahead and decided not to do it, and now he's being forced to do it. So I think he's going to move forward. The question is there precedent here? And there is precedent. Ronald Reagan did this. George H.W. Bush did this. Following congressional action, where the congressional action did not cover the people it needed to cover, the president went ahead and, using his executive authority, did this. So I think that the Republicans who want to say this is unconstitutional and this is just some crazy dictator, it's ahistoric.
That's a really, really important point. You know, taking a step back in terms of, you know, let's talk about just broad power for a moment. That's a really important point that we're going to be hearing a lot of talking heads over the next few weeks, over the next few months, decrying the fact that, oh my God, he's issuing an executive action. It's not the first time. This has been done before many times.
But it's significant in that, first of all, those, you know, prior actions regarding immigration and those things are very different in two ways. One, they did follow congressional action. Even after he had control in Senate and Congress, never got anything on immigration, didn't get it since. So there's no congressional
How likely is it that the Republican House and Senate are going to do anything when they convene in January.
They're not.
Well, I can't read. They're not likely.
Well,
but
they represent
the will of the people.
If they wanted to do something, they could have done something.
Well, and the other thing is scope. And, you know, when George Bush did it, he did it in significant situations involving, you know, victims of Katrina and, you know, children through certain disasters.
Yeah,
and
but
so
when George H.W. Bush did it, it covered millions of Americans.
Jim, weigh in on this.
Millions of
I want to get to the essence. Like, you're the president of the United States. You never have to face the voters again. Damn it, I'm going to do what I want to do. And I'm going to do it until they drag me out of this White House.
Certainly, the
president. What's wrong with that?
Certainly, the president can take unilateral action. Any president can do that, and it's been done before, mm-hmm. as you point out. This is not a precedent-setting debate we're having. I think a couple of points. One to keep in mind is that if he does take action like this and does reach, as some might say, and extend the use of executive order. It contradicts what he has said on multiple occasions, going back to a forum in Philadelphia in 2008 where he talked about reining in presidential executive orders and not abusing that and working more in partnership with with Congress. It wasn't specific to immigration necessarily, but it was a point that he made not only then, but he's made it repeatedly since then.
But you bring up a good...
Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, that key word in that, you know, point that you made is partnership. And you have a Congress that has refused to act on the issue, that has completely blockaded the issue, and that on the horizon presents no viable solution for the issue.
But objectively, you got to say, though, that he had an opportunity when he had a Congress that was democratically controlled to address this. As Dave points out, that was one of the issues in his 2008 campaign, and he didn't do it.
Well, but look, he you're right, because he decided to do health care instead.
Exactly, yeah.
That having been said, let's not forget, at least half of the Congress did take action. Mm-hmm. 69 bipartisan members voted for a comprehensive immigration bill in the U.S. Senate.
So I guess the question then is, why does he have to take action now? With a shift in Congress, take a breath. Let the new Congress come in, work with them, give them a chance to come back with a plan. And, you know, he talks about wanting to work in a partnership with the new Congress. Okay, here's an issue. Here's
an opportunity.
I think
you needed air quotes around work with them. I mean, come on.
I think it goes both ways, Dave.
Perhaps.
It definitely goes both ways.
You got to pause. 1-800-723-8289. If you're the president of the United States, why don't you just use the next 2 years? Do what you want to do. The heck with the Republicans. Actually.
Are you headed to Los Angeles? Looking for the ideal place for you and your family to relax and enjoy yourselves? A place that combines a Four Diamond Hotel experience with a convenient location? It's the Hilton Los Angeles Universal City, just steps away from Universal Studios Hollywood, CityWalk, and NBC Studios. Just a short ride to the Hollywood Walk of Fame, TCL Chinese Theater, Warner Brothers, and other popular attractions. Enjoy spacious rooms offering breathtaking views and a world-class Las Vegas-style seafood and prime rib buffet every weekend and holidays. Share family fun and enjoy the oasis of the palm tree-lined pool and whirlpool. Relax in your own private poolside cabana with a cocktail or snack at your fingertips. Book your reservation today at HiltonUniversal.com or call 1-800-774-1500. The Hilton, Los Angeles, Universal City. At HiltonUniversal.com, they let you be the star in Hollywood.
Stand by. I'm back in Chicago. Thanks for joining us. Dave, you were making the point that legalization of pot may be bad for the Democrats because of the lack of turnout.
You know, Bruce, I think that maybe some folks in Colorado just forgot to vote on Election Day.
That is very possible. That
is it
very
is
possible.
Quite possible. The
Jim, I want to go back to something you said. You said that this was during the break. You said that the message, I think, was clear that the American people wanted gridlock broken. Did I misinterpret what you were saying?
I think one of the takeaways, and I don't think I'm the only one who holds this view. One of the takeaways from the election is I think voters are frustrated and want action on big issues, whether it's immigration or, you know, jobs and the economy. They want Washington. They want Springfield. They want their elected officials to work together and get stuff done.
I think you are correct for a portion of the vote. But I would analysis that I would give is that the election was also about people who really don't like the president, and they don't like his policies. And when the president said this election is about my policies, even though all the Democrats were running against him, he gave the Republicans exactly what they wanted. And they said, okay, this is about your policies. And the biggest reason why there was a turnout is people turned their backs and turned their noses to the president. They said, Mr. President, we don't like your policies. We don't like Obamacare. We don't like anything you do. We're throwing you out, and we're throwing your minions in the Senate and House as well. You're nodding yes, Dave, or are you writing no?
No, I'm sorry. I'm still having my post-election apoplexy on this.
You're agreeing with me, though.
No, I agree with you partially, but where I don't agree with you on is that Democrats didn't put their policies on the agenda. Mm-hmm. The Democrats around the country ran away from the president in a base election, and they ran away from the people who elected this guy in the first place.
Just like
it was
idiotic. Al Gore ran away from Bill Clinton.
Correct, but more relevant, it's just like what happened in 2010. It's just like what happened in 1994. It's just like what happened to the Republicans in 2006. Off-year elections are base elections. And when you run away from the accomplishments that you've made, as they pointed out so vividly on The Daily Show the day after, you lose. And guess what? What happened? We lost. And who won? Somebody who actually decided, hey, you know what? I'm not going to run away and say, oh, I don't know who I voted for on election day for president. That was so long ago, I don't remember.
Georgia.
Well, we talk a lot about what the voters wanted at the polls. Let's talk about the eligible voters and the fact that this was the worst turnout in some 72 years. So, you know, there was a massive amount of people that just stayed home. And they didn't stay home out of protest for Obama's policies. They just stayed home because they're disgusted with politics. They hate both sides. They're tired of the game. They're tired of the talking heads on TV. And I think that this is why the base election thing is so important, because with a base election, right, when you have an agenda and you're not running away from the policies, and when you're putting a positive message out in terms of here's what we accomplished and here's a positive agenda going forward, I think we would have been able to turn out more voters.
Would you agree with George's point that the people that didn't vote, they're the ones that say, I hate the Republicans, I hate the Democrats. They didn't even show up. But the ones that did vote, the reason that those margins were down from the presidential election with Hispanics, with African Americans, and to the largest extent by people between the ages of 18 and 29, the reason that that was down was there was a huge enthusiasm gap because the president and the Democratic minions running were not speaking to the core issues.
Well, and
they weren't saying anything
I
that
think
inspired
it's more than anything, is
blacks
that
to get out
a lot
vote.
Of that base, you know, maybe they're they didn't come out in support of Obama for, I see it as this reason, and that is they couldn't bring themselves to continue the path that we're on, the poor economy, the disasters of Obamacare.
It's not a poor economy.
But here's the thing. They just couldn't bring themselves to become Republicans. And maybe that's really where the difference is.
We've had six months of the best economic growth in 10
Democrats
years. It's not a poor
that you
economy.
You can turn that over. Well, our jobs numbers are, our job participation rate is still significantly low.
Mike in Spokane, Washington, listening to us on KXLY. Go ahead. You're on the air. Go ahead, Mike.
Well, as you know, thanks, Bruce. As you know, our new archbishop in Chicago is from Spokane. So
yes.
Congratulations. Yeah, Bishop Supik. He's got a great sense of humor.
He got in the other night.
Yeah, simple lifestyle. And Our Lady of Lourdes Cathedral gave $4,000 for him to use for the people in Chicago, the poor and the homeless.
Well, very good. That was nice of you. Well, it's nice to have him with us from Spokane. Was that your comment, or did you want to talk about the Republicans?
No. Basically, I want to talk about the immigration, too. And, you know, if President Obama uses the immigration issue to use past that, it will be a huge lift for Republican presidential hopefuls.
Why?
Cause chaos. Why? because there will be they will use that issue, and Republicans will, presidential candidates, of immigration the way for, as an issue.
Let me argue against that, and then I will let you I will let our guests respond, and then I want to let you respond. I would argue that one of the reasons why the president might be doing this is he's going to say, okay, here's 5 million voters that eventually are going to vote Democratic and will probably vote Democratic the rest of their lives, and a lot of Hispanics will cheer that, and depending how the Republicans fight it, it might perpetuate an image that some Hispanics have that the Republican Party is not interested in their aspirations. And so the president, who I think is a very cunning politician, is thinking of this in that way, is that this is a way in which, you know, he thinks that he's going to lock in a lot of immigrant votes. Stephanie, you're nodding your head.
I would agree. You know, he puts the Republicans in a real quandary, and that is that if you fight the president on this action, even if it's just on the principle of him taking executive action, then you look like you're anti-immigrant, and you can't win. If you take away funding, if you do all of these things, you look like the bad guy if you fight the president.
Jim, what do you think about that?
Well, I think there are other tools in the toolbox that the Republicans in the next Congress will use. That is a risk they're going to have to weigh if the reward outweighs that risk. I think politically that is a danger. And, you know, Bruce, to come back to your point, politics is a game of addition. This is a huge opportunity to add to the base.
But here's my – I'm now perplexed twice in this broadcast. These are not voters. These are not citizens. Nobody is saying – nobody is presenting a credible pathway to citizenship for these people with this action of the president. On the contrary, I think the president's action probably discourages that from happening anytime in the near future.
You don't think they will ever become citizens?
I think it's possible, but it's when Sasha and Malia are running for office.
Does it become a political home run, Georgia? Does it become a political home run to the Hispanics around the country whose turnout this time in the off election was significant in some key states?
No, does it provide enthusiasm? Absolutely. And I do think that it provides a conundrum for the GOP, because what do they run on? Okay, so the order happens. Do they go back to repeal and replace? You know, what do you deal with? How do you deal with 5 million people?
Well, this is where I think, whether it's cunning or the cynicism of the president, he knows that the immigration issue is like the right to life issue. Mm-hmm. He knows it splits the Republican Party.
Right.
And it's an issue, it's a wedge issue that he can use against the Republicans. And he knows that the Republicans, no matter which side wins, the other side is going to be ticked off.
Well, and the reality
of the Democrats come away winners.
Right. And the reality of it is everyone sort of loses at the end of the day, because at this point, the desire to achieve true, legitimate immigration reform is thrown out the window. And we're losing that opportunity because we're not going to have the next 2 years to go through that process.
Why would it take it off the table? Yeah.
I mean, look, they had the opportunity the last 2 years, the bipartisan immigration reform bill that had a ton of money for enforcement. Mm-hmm. Republicans in the House said, we are not interested. And I promise you, the next 2 years, they're going to say, we are not interested. And I'll go even further. Probably 2 years after that, they're still going to say we're not interested under Hillary Clinton, because Hillary Clinton would throw away the store.
Let's go to Robert, listening to us in Rancho Mirage on KTPR tonight. Go ahead. You're on the air, Robert.
I have an idea I want to throw out to the panel as a quick quote. What if the president signs the 5 million green cards and then signs a second executive order deporting all criminal alien felons in state and federal prison all around this country, saving billions of dollars, helping to balance the budget? Wouldn't that be some red meat to throw out to the Republicans as a quid pro quo to make a deal?
It's interesting. I don't think the president would do that. I mean, I understand the mathematics and also the financial aspect of it. I think that too many in the Hispanic community would view that negatively. And the president at this point does not want the name Obama and deportation in the same sentence politically right now. I mean, well, you're right. He has deported more Hispanics or more people than any president in history. There's no question about that. He's done it. But it has hurt him in his Hispanic base, which is upset with him. This is all an effort to basically kiss and make up with a key constituency that he promised he was going to deliver for and hasn't delivered for him. And I think Jim's point is well taken. If he really wanted to do it, he could have done it when the Democrats were in control of everything. So it's not exactly his highest priority, except it's his highest priority right now. We've got to move. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Bruce Newman. Remember the Duma.
Everyone loves vacationing in Florida. So why not experience it as it was meant to be? Where turquoise Gulf waters meet tranquil island beaches. Feel the powder-soft sand between your toes. Revel in a glorious island sunset. Shop the boutiques of a seaside village. Ride horseback along tranquil waters. This is Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Real, authentic Florida, where you can discover an intimate downtown and sip cappuccino at a sidewalk cafe. Catch fresh fish for dinner. Even tour a working winery. Just minutes from all the rest Florida has to offer. Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Plan your visit online at BradentonGulfIslands.com. That's BradentonGulfIslands.com.
As I was saying, Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Nice to have you with us. There's an old saying in broadcasting, you know, the announcer comes in, we joined this program already in progress. So we may have already joined this program in process. Let me go around the table and let everybody introduce themselves, and we're going to start with Georgia Logothetis. I want to learn say your name the way you say it.
Sure, Logotheti.
Logothetis.
Very good.
Like a
There's no S.
Yeah. Yeah, or you can leave the S on. It's all good.
Georgia Logothetis.
I am a contributing editor at DailyCoast.com. I work in political consulting, and I'm the managing director of a foreign policy group.
Very good. Stephanie Hitt.
I'm a mother of four, a Republican activist, a reformed attorney, and I live in the People's Republic of Evanston.
Used to be in the U.S. Attorney's Office in Manhattan, right?
Many, many years ago
Rudy Giuliani was there.
Yeah, good man.
And the ever-popular Dave Logan. Dave Lundy.
Very nice. Joke. Yes, we noticed. Dave Lundy, president of Aileron Communications, a PR and public affairs strategy firm focusing on innovation and innovation companies, clean energy, digital tech, biotech, and a happy, frequent contributor to this program.
And Jim Prescott.
I'm Jim Prescott. I'm president of Prescott Group, a public affairs consulting firm. I work a lot with clients in the energy and infrastructure and transportation sectors. Basically, I help my clients get things built.
And you used to work for Jim Thompson, which is where we met. We've known each other for about 30 years.
Many years ago.
Haven't you been on this program once before? I said in the – you've never been on the show.
First time.
Really?
It's a pleasure to be here, Bruce.
We used to bring the governor over periodically. I mean, the show is celebrating its 35th anniversary next year, so you were just out of high school when we started this thing. Let's go to Fred in Austin, Texas. KLBJ is the place, one of my favorite affiliates. Fred, nice to hear from you tonight.
So I'm since we're all introducing ourselves, I'm a boat repairman who sands and paints for a living and pays attention to politics and gets infuriated at how the media gets manipulated by people.
Good.
But anyway, the general thought I have about Obama giving out green cards to all these guys is that all of a sudden, all those who hire people who are illegal immigrants will have to collect federal withholding, federal taxes, and all that from their paychecks. And no longer will the fellow who's illegal be able to take his entire $100 home, which is equivalent to a guy getting paid $150 a day. And no longer will the employers get to blow off paying their share of the FICA tax and not paying any unemployment tax. So the employers, to get the same labor, will suddenly have to pay 60% more for all than what they're paying now, anybody who's employing illegals. And as for the illegals now, what everybody does is they sign this little piece of paper with the guy that says, basically, I'm a Mexican national, and you don't get to collect taxes on me because I'm doing business in the United States. And so I'll take all the money, and I'll go pay my taxes properly in Mexico. And that's the get-around for everybody down here in Texas who's hiring illegals. So what we're suggesting is people are somehow mad about that we're going to legitimize these people, where we're actually going to cause them to contribute and pay their fair share of the taxes, other than sales taxes and property taxes that they already pay either through their where they're renting from or they pay when they buy stuff. So I don't see what the fight is. Why do people want to be against this unless it's, well, because I hire illegals all the time and it won't be profitable if you guys make me pay taxes?
Dave, it's an interesting question.
Very interesting.
The only thing that would seem to argue against that is that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce has been so enthusiastically on board the idea of doing immigration reform. They want to bring these people into the mainstream, and it's the one area where they have been supportive of the president. I'm sure that there are folks out there, probably more small businesses, possibly in the service industry, in the construction industry, that would probably agree with what you're saying. But clearly big business, they want these folks in the mainstream economy.
And also from a political strategic standpoint, Jim, the long-term strategists for the Republican Party, they want a bigger share of the Hispanic vote.
Yeah, I think if that population is broader and deeper, I think that that presents an opportunity. And you know, hardly a day goes by when you don't see some political strategists from the Republican Party talking about efforts to attract more Hispanic voters. And you know, since the caller's from Texas, the reverse issue there is, you know, there's a very aggressive effort to turn a red state, although Austin's the blue dot in that red state, turn that blue, or at least get it to purple. And this probably is part of the equation from a political strategy standpoint.
Mm-hmm. Stephanie?
Well, and I think it is interesting because, there is a very fascinating argument that if we legitimize and we have citizens and taxpayers Hispanic, you know, there's... Once they get into the workforce legitimately and they are forced to pay taxes and they are forced to deal on an economic basis with some of the issues, that the Republican policies, Republican principles might actually be more appealing.
Well, they should be attractive because of the family, because of the right to life, religion, lower taxes, hard work, and all that stuff.
But that's the real challenge the Republican Party faces, because I think in many ways their policies are more akin to the cultural values. However, Republicans have not succeeded in making that argument.
And my recollection was, didn't Reagan, when he was elected or reelected, didn't he get about 25% of the Hispanic vote?
Well,
he had a very large...
As did George W. Bush, right. May have gotten the highest.
Right.
Yeah.
Let's go to Sharon in Itasca, Illinois, listening to us on WLS, the radio home of Steve Dahl. Go ahead.
Hi. You know, my comment is that when you legalize all these 5 million people and you have a lot of 29ers, as they call them, 29 hours with the so-called Unaffordable Care Act, who can't get work beyond that certain time point, you're going to basically reduce the value of work, meaning when you open up a Walmart, people are competing by the thousands for maybe a couple of jobs that are $8-$9 an hour. Well, the Hispanics who will suddenly, and other groups, I'm sure, who are going to be, have been picking fruit and lettuce on behalf of our supermarkets, aren't going to want to do that work anymore. They're going to want to go to the fast food places. They're going to want other jobs. And, of course, the value of the worker goes down because you have a glut then within the system competing with American workers who are having a heck of a hard time finding employment. These numbers that came out with the employment numbers, you've got certain areas that are doing well and other areas that are just depressed. You know, Illinois isn't doing that good with work. I've heard this one man I know, 49 years old, he wants to get married later in life and start a family, but they won't give him anything beyond 29 hours a week. So this is the quandary that we're stuck in. You're displacing American workers, and I don't understand why the Democrats claim they're for the working guy and the little guy and wind up doing slapping the working guy and the little guy right upside the head with
their policies. Georgia, what's that all about?
Wow, that was
a lot. Let's start unpacking it. I think we can begin first from the premise that, you know, this is still a marketplace. And the person that is the hiring manager is looking at all of his candidates. And if he's got people that are qualified for the job versus, you know, people that just got, you know, the ability to apply for the job that may not have the qualifications, that hiring manager, he or she will obviously go with a more qualified candidate. So it's not necessarily that there's going to be this massive influx of people that are going to take American jobs. Yes, they will be competing, especially at some of these, you know, entry-level positions. But competition is a good thing in our economy. I think so.
It suppresses wages, though. That's my problem. You're keeping the value of the working wage down by flooding the market all of a sudden, and we're having a hard enough time getting wages up right now for people who are just trying to hold down jobs, let alone getting the hours to complete a full-time week.
So I assume the caller is in favor of increasing the minimum wage to combat that phenomena.
Actually, the caller looks at that, and we know darn well what's going to happen. You wind up suppressing the economy by doing that. $10 an hour, if you're looking at someone that two people or three people that you have working for you, I've never paid anybody minimum wage. But I've known other friends and relatives who have had small businesses, and they'll let one or two people go and put the hours just on one-star worker. So I'm sorry. It has a way of suppressing the economy to that extent.
Well, the economic data over the course of decades doesn't support you on that.
Go ahead, Dave.
The economic data over the course of decades of raising the minimum wage does not support your contention, because what has happened is that you raise the minimum wage, you put more money in these people's pockets, they're still at the bottom end of the economy, they're forced to spend that money, they spend that money invested in the economy and result in stimulating the economy. This has been seen over and over and over again. So you can
Actually, that's a Democratic talking point, and it's wrong, because you know what? When Obama had control of both houses, he could have raised the minimum federal wage to $15 an hour, and he didn't do it.
That's a non sequitur, ma'am.
They know darn well that it will cripple the economy. You guys do it incrementally.
But you say that Obama didn't do it because he thought it would cripple the economy. But again, what about
the Democrats? What I'm saying, why didn't they just vote to have the federal minimum wage $15-$18 an hour when he had both houses?
Well, I think that's a legitimate question on a lot of things
well,
the Democrats
I'm laughing.
Talk
you're,
about.
And you're a Democrat and analyst,
so what is the answer to that?
Well, the answer is I don't think
let's let Dave, we got him on the hook here.
I don't think that they anticipated that they were going to get shellacked in 2010. So they didn't expect that they were going to have a 2-year presidency.
So in other words, they thought that the people who were making below minimum wage could survive 2 years on what they were making. They thought it was okay to let these Hispanic families that were being torn apart that Luis Gutierrez tells us about. In other words, they basically said, we're going to let you wait because we have 2 years. We have the power to do whatever we want, but we're going to let you wait. And that's to be viewed as a party that has empathy and compassion.
The Democrats
I think you're forgetting what 2009 and 2010 were like. Nobody, not the staunchest advocate, was saying that was the right time to raise the minimum wage. I wouldn't say that, and I'm a huge advocate for increasing the minimum wage. Right. It's about timing, it's about sequence, it's about amount.
And it's about power and when you've got the votes. Back shortly from Chicago.
Are you headed to Los Angeles? Looking for the ideal place for you and your family to relax and enjoy yourselves? A place that combines a 4-diamond hotel experience with a convenient location? It's the Hilton Los Angeles Universal City, just steps away from Universal Studios Hollywood, CityWalk, and NBC Studios. Just a short ride to the Hollywood Walk of Fame, TCL Chinese Theater, Warner Brothers, and other popular attractions. Enjoy spacious rooms offering breathtaking views and a world-class Las Vegas-style seafood and prime rib buffet every weekend and holidays. Share family fun and enjoy the oasis of the palm tree-lined pool and whirlpool. Relax in your own private poolside cabana with a cocktail or snack at your fingertips. Book your reservation today at HiltonUniversal.com or call 1-800-774-1500. The Hilton Los Angeles Universal City. At HiltonUniversal.com, they let you be the star in Hollywood.
Dave is listening to us on WLS. Go ahead. Dave, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. I have to laugh. I think
Paul, whatever his name was, confirmed that the Democrats know their voters are stupid, but this guy that you got on your panel talking about the minimum wage has to understand you have a lot of Republicans in the audience, and we are not stupid economically. I'm a small business person. I'm a health care provider. I know a lot of Hispanic citizens who prefer law-abiding citizens and not the criminally ones that are here. And as far as the Democrat mantra, education, keep them dumb. Pot, keep them dope. And keep them dependent on government. My concern is when you're looking at the immigration situation, a lot of these people are not coming here offering anything to this country except a hand that's sticking out and come here with kids that are going on the dole making kids to get a check. And what I see, if we're going to have this happening, the people who were here for maybe generations or for one generation who paid into the system are going to have no money, just like the veterans are getting pushed around, because you're going to have people coming here with their hand out. And as far as the minimum wage is concerned, as a small business person, if I'm going to hire somebody and I'm going to pay a higher wage and they don't have any experience, what am I supposed to do to train them? Tell them you got a free training program, work for me 90 days for no pay, or go to a school and get training for $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, and then maybe I'll pay you $15 an hour.
Dave Lundy.
You know, I think that the idea that immigrants are coming here with their hand out, it's again, it's not supported by the data. The data very clearly shows that most of the immigrants, including the undocumented who are here, are working often two, three jobs because they get paid the sub-minimum wage. They don't get paid the minimum wage because they're not in the commercial economy. They're in the under economy. So, you know, this idea that immigrants are coming here just to get these fat benefits, it's just not supported by the data.
Dave, I also want to challenge you on one point, and I think it may be on your premise, and that is, and again, I have no way of proving what I'm about to say, but that happens frequently on talk radio. I believe the majority, maybe the vast majority of Hispanics who live in this country, who are citizens of this country, I think some of them are the most vociferous opponents of open borders or illegal immigration, because I think they believe that as more people sneak into the country, their jobs may be in jeopardy for the reasons we've discussed this evening. And also, many of them, perhaps a majority of them, came to this country legally, and I think if you do things legally, whether you're Hispanic, white, or black, you don't like people who are doing things illegally, because I think it is human nature. People don't like other people who sneak in line. And so I think a media perception is that all Hispanics are monolithic and they're going to hate the Republicans. I think that's wrong. And when there was a vote several years ago in the state of California, the Hispanics, by a majority vote, the majority of Hispanics voted to crack down on illegal immigration. But the media, I think, perpetuates. They put everything together, as do the Democrats. They lump it all together as if it's, you know, if you speak up against illegal immigration, you're speaking up against all Hispanics. That's not the case. You have to separate the Hispanics who work and come here and have families and are God-fearing American citizens, sometimes new American citizens. You've got to separate those from people who do and have illegally come into this country.
Well, and one of the things, not to interrupt, but that it's important is, and I agree wholeheartedly with you, Bruce, that, again, I don't have the statistics on that, but I think there is a large number of people who did things fairly. I mean, we have an innate sense of fairness in this country. And, you know, they waited the 10 years or whatever and got the legitimate paperwork. One of the things that I think is, maybe this is my idealism as a Republican or an American, but there are a lot of people that come to America for opportunity to work, opportunity to be educated, opportunity to grow. They want to be
an
better.
An opportunity
to
steal.
And they want better lives. I mean, we were in Italy, and the ticket agent in Italy said to my daughters, "You're so lucky you're American. I wish I had an American boyfriend. You can be anything you want. You can have any job you want." So this is not just coming from Mexico. It's coming from other countries. And I think it leads me back to the point of, though that's the kind of immigration America was built on, and that's where the kind of things that need to be discussed in real, true immigration reform.
I just want to get a word in. I deal with this every day. In fact, I'm a benefactor. I take a lot of people who have government assistance. But the thing is, in some conversations I have, I literally had somebody tell me that's where they choose not to work. They don't want to go to school because it's too much money. They don't want to work because they got kids. They want to stay home. And my concern is, as I see, maybe disproportionately, so many people coming here, and all they expect is for America to give them multiple organ transplants and take care of their family,
I just want to be clarified. Are you specifically referring to Hispanics?
There's other groups besides them, but the majority are Hispanic.
Okay.
I
don't want to say that you're telling the truth, but you know what? It flies in the face of everything that I've experienced in all my years on this earth. Some
well,
of the
my
hardest
daily
working
experience.
People that
I
know.
I don't have video recorders, but I
most
see
of
it every
them
day.
Are legal. Some of them may be illegal, but most Hispanics like to work.
Well, I'm not doubting that, but I'm telling you what I
farewell.
See.
Dan Dorfman and Colin Bobbitt helped make this program possible. I'm Bruce Dumont. Until next week, this is Bruce Dumont saying so long from Chicago.